Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're taking a step back from international news this week. Instead, we have an installment in our periodic series of interviews with distinguished journalists and writers. Joining us now is Leonard Pitts Jr., a Pulitzer-winning columnist for the Miami Herald. Pitts is well known for columns dealing with race, gay rights, religion, and other cultural issues. His column on September 12, 2001, called "We'll Go Forward from This Moment," is particularly well known for directly addressing the perpetrators of the September 11 attacks. Pitts is also a writer whose works of fiction and nonfiction have drawn critical acclaim. His novels include Grant Park, about a disillusioned African-American newspaper columnist, and Freeman, about an escaped slave who makes a dangerous journey back to the South after the Confederate surrender. His nonfiction includes the book Becoming Dad, Black Men, and the Journey to Fatherhood. In addition to the Pulitzer, Pitts has won numerous journalism awards from groups like the National Association of Black Journalists and the Society for Professional Journalists, and most recently, a 2017 Honor Medal from the Missouri School of Journalism. Leonard Pitts, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, you write about lots of things. One of the themes you repeatedly touch on in your work is fatherhood. Yeah. You grew up with a father who was abusive, alcoholic. You went on to graduate from high school, I think, at 16, from college at 19,
right.
Had a sterling academic professional career. How did you get that push to succeed?
I had a imperfect father and a better than perfect mom is the short answer. When you're raised by Wonder Woman, things tend to happen. I had a very good mom who pushed us all and believed in us all and really did not believe in settling for less than your best. So. I was perhaps unfortunate on one end of the equation, but more than compensated for it on the other end.
And was there a particular moment or experience that pushed you into writing?
No, I always say that I knew I was a writer pretty much from the time I knew anything about words. I told everybody that I was a writer, not that I was going to be a writer, but that I was a writer when I was 5 years old. And started writing stories and things then, started sending them out to magazines seeking publication when I was 12. So there was never a decision process. This was something that was always sort of in me and that I knew that this was the path I would follow.
You started out as a music journalist in Los Angeles, interviewed a lot of people, Barry mm-hmm. White, Al Green, Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
You worked for Casey Kasem on Casey Kasem's Top 40. Seems like a pretty cool job. Why did you move away from that?
I did 18 years as a music critic, and there's a saying that the average lifespan of a successful act is 5 years, which means I was in it for almost four lifetimes. And by the end, I wasn't feeling the same love that I once had. I had started out in the era of Al Green and Barry White, and I ended up in the era of New Kids on the Block and, as he was then billed, Snoop Doggy Dogg. And it will or will not shock you, but I didn't feel a whole lot of affinity for Mr. Dogg or for the New Kids, and I just felt like I needed to do something else with my life because I wasn't getting the same enjoyment that I had been.
Well, you're probably best known for the column that you wrote after the September 11 attacks, "We'll Go Forward from This Moment," which was addressed to the terrorists who committed the attacks. And for those who aren't familiar, I'm just going to read a passage from it. When roused, we are righteous in our outrage, terrible in our force. When provoked by this level of barbarism, we will bear any suffering, pay any cost, go to any length in the pursuit of justice. I tell you this without fear of contradiction. I know my people, as you, I think, do not. What I know reassures me. It also causes me to tremble with dread of the future. 16 years later, how do you think that column has stood the test of time? Are you reassured about the America that you spoke about then?
No, I'm not reassured at all. I think that most of what I predicted there came to pass. I did know that there would be a retribution. I did know that the perpetrator would be brought to pay for the crime. But what I could not fully appreciate then was how the Islamophobia that incident unleashed in us would still be with us 16 years later and in some ways stronger than ever. I couldn't really appreciate at that moment how much the cultural intolerance, including Islam and beyond Islam, that was encoded in our response to that would become part of our daily lives 16 years later. So in that regard, I'm disappointed in where we've come. But, in terms of retribution, that was a given. I think I get too much credit for calling that because if you spend any time in America, you know that there would you had to have known that there would be some retribution.
Well, in speaking about sort of this moment in the news business, you address this in a recent column in which you seem to sort of despair of our ability to change people's minds with facts. You talked about tell us about that. You talked about an African-American soldier in World War One in a column several years ago named Henry Johnson. Tell us his story and what some of the reaction was to that.
Henry Johnson was a 5'3" or 4", 130-pound African-American man. He'd been a baggage handler in Albany, New York. He went to war in 1918 as part of the 369th Infantry. And his story briefly is that in May, I think it's the 15th of 1918, he's in a forward observation post, which is essentially a hole in the ground, when he and his partner Needham Roberts are overrun by a force of Germans. The low end estimate of that force is 12. The high end estimate runs closer to 30. I usually use a 12 figure. Needham Roberts, his partner, is wounded pretty early and taken out of battle. And Henry Johnson single-handedly outfights all of these Germans. His gun is jammed, and he is wounded 21 times, but he defeats the Germans and lives to tell the tale.
And well, tell us about what some of the reaction was, because I understand that you got some email from a reader named Ken who said that the whole episode, your whole story, was basically politically correct bull.
Yeah, Ken said that the whole story of one black man defeating a dozen Nazi was, quote, PC bull, and that there were no blacks in the army. The army wasn't integrated until 1947. I pointed out to Ken that, first of all, the army was integrated in 1952. Second of all, there were African Americans fighting in every American war since the Revolution. And three, that I'm having a Rick Perry moment. And
well, you said, I think, you know, part of the point of your column was that you provided your readers with all the citation.
Yeah, that's it.
With passages from history books.
I provided him with all of the documentation that he could want for this story. And what amazed me was that he, not only did he continue to dispute the fact of the story, but he felt no need to even engage with the documentation that I'd provided with him, which for me was sort of a watershed moment in my understanding of how much of a facts optional or indeed facts free society we as Americans had become. When I can understand him finding it difficult to believe, but when I provide documentation and you don't, not only do you not refute the documentation, you feel no need to even engage the documentation, that's telling me something about the mind of the country. And I've seen that mindset in many people since then.
Well, do you think this is just a passing fever, or is this something that is more permanent?
If it's a passing fever, it's been passing for a while now. I first noticed it and noticed people talking about it in 2004 and 5. And my encounter with Ken was in probably 2010 or 11, and we're well beyond that now. So I don't think it's a passing fever. I think this is an integral part of who we are as Americans now, an integral and regrettable part of who we are as Americans now. And I despair of what we're going to do or what's going to happen with us as a country if we don't get a hold of it.
You're listening to Global Journalist. On today's program, we're taking a break from our regular focus on international news for an installment on our periodic series of interviews with distinguished journalists. We're joined today by Leonard Pitts Jr., an author and well-known columnist for the Miami Herald. Leonard, you write frequently about race, and we are doing this interview in Missouri, which has been a flashpoint in our national dialogue on race in the past couple of years. What parallels do you see between the Black Lives Matter movement, which I think was really inspired in part by the Michael Brown case in St. Louis, and the civil rights protests of the 60s and 70s?
Well, I think that both movements grow out of people's frustration with the unfairness of status quo, an onerous status quo. I think that they both are organic in that sense. There's not a lot of There certainly wasn't a lot of calculation in the Montgomery bus boycott and in a lot of those movements that are sort of signal moments now in American history. And I don't think there was a lot of calculation in the initial response to Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice. There's just sort of a sense of fatigue. Martin Luther King said it best in the first address he gave at the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. There comes a time when people get tired. And when people get tired, things happen. So I think there is that parallel. Where they diverge, I think, is that Black Lives Matter and some of the more modern movements have yet to articulate, at least where I've seen, an agenda of what they want to see happen, what they want us to do, how they want us to respond. I think that's a particular weakness of some of these modern movements, period. I think the same weakness was seen in the Occupy movement earlier in this decade, where they got our attention and we kind of understood what it was that they were upset about, but they never really articulated what steps they wanted the rest of us as Americans to take to solve this. The civil rights movement, you have to understand, always had clear goals for the things that they were demonstrating about. The Montgomery bus boycott wasn't just to demonstrate against segregation. They wanted integrated buses. They had a list of things that they wanted to see happen. Same with the 1963 march in Birmingham or the Freedom Rides in 61. And I think we need to see that kind of clarity now with these modern movements.
The violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, a few months ago, where we had this white supremacist neo-Nazi march, it had a profound impact on a lot of people. Just to go back to sort of our earlier question, do you get the sense that when we look back on this episode several years from now, that this will view this as an aberration, or was it, you know, something that's a harbinger of things to come, and we'll say like, oh yes, this is when culture shifted, or this is a touchstone of when our culture shifted?
I think these are watershed moments. I don't know that the Charlottesville event or Charleston are so much the beginning of something as they are the outcome of something. I think that they are the outcome, and we're going to continue to see outcomes like that, but the outcome of sort of an increased openness and an increased pride, I guess, for want of a better term, from people who have these kinds of feelings. They were driven. The mistake that we made was in believing that after the civil rights movement ended, that the people who felt this way were driven away. They were not driven away. They were driven underground. It was no longer possible to be a respectable, quote unquote, human being, and hold these opinions. You weren't welcome in polite company. And what they are telling us, particularly with the Charlottesville event, is that they no longer feel that stricture, at least no longer feel it as much, that they can be hateful and still hold their heads up in public. And that's been going for a while. I think that 9/11 itself had a role to play with that, because 9/11 made Islamophobia a little more quote-unquote respectable. There were suddenly people who were preaching it on cable news networks who were speaking pretty much straight Islamophobia, but they had the imprimatur of a cable news network, or they were putting out a book or whatever. So I think that the shift is at least that old, and it's just getting more and more brazen, more and more open, and more deadly, potentially deadly.
Well, I was just what you're saying reminds me of a conversation I had recently with an Italian journalist who was visiting here recently, and she was interested in sort of the current protests in St. Louis and elsewhere. And she was a little bit confused at how America could both be the America of Charlottesville, but also the same America that elected a black man to be sort of first among us. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of struggling with how to answer that question.
Here's how I would answer that question. The fact that we elected a black man to be first among us leads directly to Charlottesville, because the fact that man was able to become president scared the heck out of a lot of folks who realized that the demographic changes that are coming in this country are no longer theoretical, that they are there. The Census Bureau has been saying for some years that by the year 2040, there will no longer be such a thing as a racial majority in this country. We'll all be minorities. I think that, coupled with the rising visibility of Muslim Americans, of transgender Americans, of gay and lesbian Americans, the increasing outcry of immigrant Americans, really sort of galvanized those forces of intolerance to say that we need to, quote unquote, take our country back. And that's pretty explicitly what the code means. Take our country back and or make America great again means that we need to be in a position where we, straight, white, male, native born, et cetera, are the ones who are in charge, are on top again. And the Obama, it's wrong to look at the Obama election and what's happening now as sort of counterweights. The one, in my view, led directly to the other. I think it's no mistake that we're now seeing these studies indicating that, contrary to what a lot of journalists were reporting and claiming during the campaign, the voters who voted for Donald Trump did not do so out of economic anxiety. They did so out of cultural insecurity. out of, I think the statement that one of the studies used was, this doesn't feel like my country anymore. Do you agree with this statement? And the people who agreed with that statement were the people who were more likely to vote for Donald Trump.
Well, I wanted to ask you about your own personal experiences as well. You have received death threats in the past for your work, most notably in 2007. Tell us about that incident.
I wrote a column about a couple of a young white couple that was brutally murdered by four or five African Americans in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I wrote the column in response to some white supremacists who said that this was genocide, and that the national news media had shied away from reporting this because of, you know, over political correctness. And the point that I made in the column was that black, you know, African American violence is not over, it's not underreported by news media out of any political correctness. As a matter of fact, statistically, it has been shown to be overreported. By almost all measures, and I said that these people were using this tragedy to propound an absurd and offensive idea of their victimization, and I said that those people should cry me a river. And what happens a lot of times when you do that kind of stuff is that people will take one thing that you said, and they will, and we're seeing it now with the NFL protests, people will pretend that you said something that you didn't say, or that you meant something that you didn't mean. So suddenly I'm portrayed as saying, cry me a river, to the families of these two victims, which is such an obscene lie that I don't even have the words to really explain it. But that's their vision, that's what they're putting out there, and it's based on that all of this, start getting this neo-Nazi or professed neo-Nazi guy puts contact information online, my contact information online, and invites his followers to contact me. And from then on, it's an interesting season.
Well, one of my favorite columns that you've written is one from back in 2008 on the 40th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination. You wrote about the sanitation workers' strike in Memphis that King was helping to lead when he was in Memphis when he was assassinated. This April will be the 50th anniversary of his death. What progress do you see since you wrote that column 10 years ago? Do you still feel that, to paraphrase Dr. King, sort of the arc of the moral universe is still bending forward?
He said the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. I do believe that. But I think the key word is long. I think the key word in that is long, because in the short term, you mentioned that 10 years. In the short term, no, the arc seems to be bending toward anything but. It seems to be bending toward retrenchment. It seems to be bending toward reversal of a lot of the progress that we made since Dr. King walked the earth. And that is that's a sad and troubling thing. But again, the key word is long.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're taking a break from our regular coverage of international news issues to speak with Leonard Pitts Jr., an award-winning columnist for the Miami Herald. If you're interested in more Global Journalist, you can visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can access archives of this program, as well as additional coverage of underreported foreign news and human rights issues. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter, subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube, or get our podcast from iTunes or SoundCloud. I wanted to return to this theme of fatherhood. We talked about your own father recently, and I'll remind everyone, Leonard has written a couple books on this subject in 1999. He wrote Becoming Dad, Black Men, and the Journey to Fatherhood. The 2006 novel, Before I Forget, also focused on this theme of fatherhood. Why has this been a focus of your work?
Well, probably daddy issues like a lot of us. I was interested in writing the first book, the nonfiction book, just to sort of explore some things in my life, some underpinnings in my life that I hadn't really had a chance to sort of work through before. And writing is how I work through a lot of things. Writing, as I'm fond of saying, is cheap psychotherapy. So, there was that. And then I came back to it in the novel Before I Forget, because it struck me that while this was, you know, was great underpinning for a nonfiction study, it was probably just as good, if not better, as fertile ground for looking at it through fiction. You know, nonfiction is about facts. Fiction is about truths, emotional truths. And so I felt like in writing the novel, in writing Before I Forget, I could probably get at some emotional truths that perhaps I wasn't able to get at in writing the nonfiction study.
Well, as a parent now, I notice this just in going to different kids' activities that you see so many kids where it's always the mom that is there with them. Why do you think this has become so commonplace in our society now, where the mother raises the children on her own and dad is just, it seems like someone who drops in now and then?
Yeah, I think dads have come to, we've come to define fatherhood solely in economic dimensions. When I did Becoming Dad, I would hear a lot of fathers talk about how, you know, say with pride that, you know, their child was never at a loss for diapers and baby formula and all those things. And that's lovely. That's certainly a necessary component. But I think that we as men, and frankly society, tends to undervalue the things that come from our very presence, from being there as men. I think that there are things that we bring to the table that are typically not brought by mom. And vice versa. I think mom brings things to the table that we don't bring, and that the lucky child has access to both those things.
And you've said in the past that the African American community in particular celebrates the strong women who sort of hold it all together, hold their family together. But you've also said that there's a problem and that there isn't a stigma on the men who disappear.
There's no stigma on men, and I hope this is changing since I wrote the book, but there's not a stigma on men from whatever community that disappear. Mothers who disappear from their families, I think, are held in much greater, much worse repute than fathers who do. And again, I think that's because the father's contribution is not necessarily valued in the same way or in the same degree as a mom's contribution, especially if he's writing checks. And I try to tell young fathers all the time that, you know, your physical and emotional presence is required for the health of that child, and that's, to me, that's non-negotiable.
In your writing recently, you've referred to the Trump administration as the Fourth Reich. You've called members of the administration trolls. You have brought up clamoring from under their bridges. You've called folks in the administration a coterie of cartoon autocrats. Do you get the sense that there is room for dialogue and compromise between liberals and the Trump administration?
You think I've been too subtle? Actually, no. And it pains me to say that, because one of the hallmarks of my life and one of the hallmarks of my political belief has always been the value of dialogue. It's always been, you know, that well-meaning people from whatever political ideology can usually talk it out. Whatever it might be. But I think that the it in the specific case of Donald Trump is an intolerance that is so profound that there is no room for talking it out. I can talk it out if you're for small government and I'm for more government. We can talk it out if you think one thing should happen in Syria and I think another thing should happen in Syria. But if you are proponent of or a speaker of racist ideologies or misogynistic stuff or Islamophobic stuff, there's no ground for talking it out. There's no space for doing that. So to me, it's not even ideological so much as it is character driven. And it troubles me that frankly that 63 million of my fellow Americans were able to look at Mr. Trump, who was not hiding in the least this hatred, this bigotry, and we're able to make themselves okay with that. And I don't know if you've seen the notorious New York Times video from the rallies, but it would just sicken you, the kinds of things that were very commonplace that were being said by those folks. So I don't know how to find common ground with those folks, and frankly, they're not folks that I'd want to find common ground with. There's occasions in this life where there are people where people believe things so vile that it is good to be, you know, to be found in opposition to them. That, you know, sometimes you're judged by the company you keep, but you're also judged by the people who don't want to keep company with you. And these are folks that I don't want to keep company with.
And so, where does that leave us for the next 3 years if people share your
It leaves
share
us in
your views.
It leaves us in a lot of trouble. That's what I've been saying for a long time. It leaves us in a lot of trouble. It leaves us where we are, you know, now. We are as a country and as a society in a world of hurt, because I don't know what the next step is. I don't know where we go from that. And again, I have to stress this. This is not ideological. If we were talking about George W. Bush, with whom I disagreed, or George H.W. or Ronald Reagan or whatever, we're not having this discussion. But we are having this discussion specifically because we're talking about somebody whose platform was so vile to Islamic Americans, immigrants, African Americans, women, et cetera, and et cetera. I don't know how to come together with that. I don't know how to find healing with that.
Well, you've also been quite critical, mm-hmm. I think, in some regards to arguments that people on the left have made about the reasons for Trump's rise.
Right.
Was the news media not tough enough or give him too much of a platform during the campaign? Or different folks on the left have blamed James Comey mm-hmm. or Hillary Clinton for running a poor campaign. You've been quite outspoken saying the problem is us. The problem is the American people.
Yeah, I think all of the above is true. You know, Comey had an impact. Hillary Clinton's campaign had an impact. But I think for me, the biggest disappointment, I guess I would say, is, as I said a moment ago, the fact that 63 million people looked at what he represented and we're okay with it. And that's an issue of us as Americans. It's not an issue of Comey or Clinton or the journalists. You know, there were journalistic failings, obviously. But that's not an issue of any of that. That's an issue of the American people deciding that this was what they wanted. I felt the same way when David Duke won, I think it was 43%, I may be wrong, but 43% of the vote for the Louisiana governorship. What's wrong with us? You know, what's wrong?
Well, tell us, you've been in this business for three, almost four decades now. Mm-hmm. What other journalists, columnists inspire you?
It's actually four decades and a year now, but thank you. I like George Will. I like Kathleen Parker. I'm a big fan of Dana Milbank of the Washington Post. I like Dave Barry, who's sort of semi-retired now, but I'm a big fan of Dave's. I like anybody that is thinking, obviously Dave's a humor columnist, but anybody that is thinking through these tough issues and it has some kind of thoughtful take on it is somebody that I'm interested in reading.
Well, our time does grow short, and actually I did get sort of a sense of pessimism from you today. Looking forward 5 years, 6 years, where do you see some reasons for optimism?
In a minute and a half, some reasons for optimism. The one reason for optimism that I have been able to find, because you're right, there is a certain amount of pessimism. The one reason for optimism that I've been able to find is that, as Barack Obama said during the campaign, America can change, and America can change fairly easily. America can change for the price of a vote in China, in Cuba, and in other places. There's blood in Egypt. There's blood in the streets required for change to happen. America can make change for the price of a vote. So that's the hope that I see, that we will see the need to transfigure this nation and save this nation and do so.
That's going to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Leonard Pitts Jr. for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Juwan Choi, Waverly Colville, and Samantha Lucas, the supervising producer, Rachel Foster Gimbel. Elisa Blyle is our visual editor and Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.